Hiya, Rose. Looking beautiful as usual. You look a bit out of sorts, though. Are you still getting the hang of space travel?
You know, I didn't use my spaceship this time. I was too busy, so I just beamed in. I know you've been against it, having your molecules rearranged and everything, but it does save a lot of time.
Ah, that's okay. I'll just keep doing it the old-fashioned way, flying in with Twiggy. I hate to have my nose end up on the other side of my face.
That doesn't happen anymore, Colin. That only happened once, and it was a long time ago, and it was an improvement for that guy anyway.
Yeah, maybe. But me and Twiggy have fast become friends, so I'll stick with him. Anyway, as I was saying, you seem a little distracted.
Oh, no, I'm good. I'm just checking out my NFTs and my digital wallet and, well, you know me, trying to understand the secrets of the metaverse, but thanks for asking.
Such a deep thinker, Rose. Seeking the secrets of the universe, are we?
Metaverse, not universe. Although, if you figured out the latter, let me know.
You know what? Everybody's talking about the metaverse these days. How did you get so savvy?
Our show, of course, The Sync Report. We are the first series being produced and broadcast from the metaverse. I want to make sure I leave my fingerprints.
I heard Kevin talking about creating the Sync Report metaverse. I think he's calling it the Zadiverse. I tuned out once I realized he wasn't running lines. What's this about your fingerprints?
It's exciting. Our metaverse is being created as we speak. The set is metaverse, space station, our solar system, every set we create from our conversations. Best of all, our audience can join us here on set and explore all the environments. So I'm thinking about what the Rose Metaverse should look like.
Oh, yeah. That's pretty cool. I guess I better get in on this, too. Maybe something with a pirate ship? Right, Rose?
That would be great, Colin. What an amazing idea. Could be fun way to travel if you make it space-worthy. Sounds like it could be big enough to have plenty of people on board. Maybe even a swimming pool for your guests to hang out and meet each other.
Leave it to Rose to turn Captain Hook into Captain Stupid. Yeah, Colin, need a bartender named Isaac, and you've got the space version of Love Boat.
Welcome to The Sync Report, the intersection between filmmakers, content creators, and musicians, where we host a weekly conversation with some of the biggest names in film, television, music, and entertainment. Meet industry experts and top-level musicians as we pull the curtain back on music placement and scores, building vital relationships and providing real opportunities for our listeners. Listen to indie filmmakers and content creators present their latest productions and describe specific scenes as they consider music submitted by our audience. Hosted by film star and musician Colin O'Donoghue and his co-host, the godmother of independent films, Rose Ganguza, and The Sync Report's creator and music supervisor, Jason P. Rothberg. Don't forget, tell your friends about us and remember to rate, comment, and subscribe to The Sync Report on Apple and across all platforms. Music is the difference between a good film and a great one.
Welcome to The Sync Report.
Thank you, Milfredo and Willow, for that lovely introduction, and welcome to The Sync Report. I'd like to welcome the godmother of film, Rose Ganguza, to the stage. Hi, Rose, how are you?
Hey, how you doing, Colin?
I'm good, thanks.
How are things in Ireland, Colin?
Things are still very, very COVID-y, so yeah. But we're getting
through. We're lucky that we're on a spaceship or in the galaxy.
Yes.
Place.
Yes.
No weather.
No weather problems, no any problems.
Well, welcome, Rose. And of course, we have to welcome music supervisor extraordinaire, Jason P. Rothberg. Jason.
We're the Misfits. Very pleased to have you.
Oh, thanks very much for having me. I'm pretty certain I'm not the leader, Jason, but thank you very much.
On this stage you are, my friend.
Well, of course, we have to welcome our DJ, producer, and music curator, Milfredo Seven, to the stage. Hey, Milfredo.
Yes, Colin. How's things, mate?
Yeah, not so bad.
You got a bit of an echo going on. Are you in the south wing of your manor house tonight, then? You just got a nice little, like you're in a big hollow room.
Does it sound like an echo? I'm in the library. So,
yeah. There you go. I bet the wind whistles through that manor house of yours, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. Colonel Mustard is curled up in the corner of the room here, so.
Milfredo, I was going to ask you, what do you think? Colin's show, how's he holding up? He's not a bad host, is he?
It's a dream. It's an absolute dream. Once he gets, have we seen his avatar yet? Have we seen it before?
Honestly, no, it's like, it sucks. And you know what? You can't even say anything because you, both of you guys have these gorgeous avatars. And Lisa keeps making fun of me because I keep trying to update mine. And she's like, did he get Botox? Did he get Botox?
I was saying, Colin, I love your little 5 o'clock shadow. And then you've got this little piece of hair that kind of swings on your forehead as you
move. All right, easy.
Boing.
I was told I would have the best looking avatar, or I'm doing one.
You had the best looking avatar.
Exactly.
And then we, signed Colin.
I'm some young gun. Coming in and calling the shots. No, man.
Who's that, Colin? You got somebody else on stage, it looks like.
Well, she's the one and only producer, Paula Flack. Hey, Paula, how are you?
I'm all right, thank you very much. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Good to see you all.
I'm good. Well, likewise.
Yeah, Colin, do you ever run around in the leather and the eyeliner?
you just said that out loud, Jason.
Right there at that moment, I'm gonna predict the future. Milfredo's gonna put a boing sign behind.
You got it, mate. You got to be exposed. Someone's got to expose you, and I'm the man to do it.
I do have my whole leather costume here.
Oh, don't, Colin. You're just encouraging him.
Come on. I know who I'm doing Halloween with.
Yeah.
Colin, take out an injunction on him as quickly as you can.
Believe me, I'm very close to.
So, Colin, joining you as a guest host today, we have the original bass player for the Sex Pistols, Glenn Matlock. He was their key songwriter, responsible for 10 out of the 12 tracks on their only studio album,
Incredible.
Never Mind the Bollocks, Here's the Sex
Incredible.
Pistols. Including the punk anthem, Pretty Vacant. After leaving the Pistols, Matlock formed The Rich Kids with the nicest man in pop music, Majur, Steve New, and Rusty Egan. After this, he formed The Spectres and then Hot Club with Generation X guitarist James Stevenson. Glenn has recorded with Iggy Pop and a band called Dead Horse. In 1996, he released a full-on guitar album through Alan McGee's Creation Records, home of Oasis, in case you didn't know. Over the years, he has joined a number of Pistols reunion tours, been part of many bands, including the Philistines, the Flying Padawanis, and Slinky Vagabond with Earl Slick and Clem Burke and Keenan Duffy.
Wow.
In 2011, the International Swingers were formed, comprised of Matlock, Clem Burke of Blondie, James Stevenson, and Gary Quinn. In 2018, with both Earl Slick and Slim Jim, he released the solo album, Good To Go. During 2020 and 2021, Glenn performed on a few online and live concerts, including Rockdown, which is a global music festival, Rock and the Trust, and Portobello Live 2021. In 2021, Glenn and Earl Slick cut a limited edition vinyl of two tracks, Consequences Coming and Constant Craving. And in August this year, he is scheduled to perform on the Great Rock and Roll Sea Cruise, which looks like a lot of fun.
Oh my God, mega lineup.
I know.
Mega lineup. It was when Glenn was working with Earl, I got a chance to work with him. I met Glenn actually in London with Rat Scabies. Glenn joined a tribute to Brian Jones that we did at Kenny Jones's Polo Grounds. And at that time, I didn't even realize that Glenn had worked with the Faces. That was just such an incredible...
He's got an amazing, amazing history.
Incredible.
Should we welcome Glenn Matlock to the stage?
Let's welcome Glenn!
Hey, Glenn, how are you? Welcome to the Sync Report.
It's interesting to be here. I'm still trying to get the line of the line.
Hey, Glenn, all right?
Yeah, I've been in Bristolian Borough there,
Yeah. Once you've got it, you never get rid of it, unfortunately. I think we crossed paths as well when we signed to EMI. I remember you coming in and we were all like, oh my God, this is Sex Pistols. It was kind of like, your picture was on that hallway.
Milfredo was in the band EMF.
Oh, I like them. I DJ, but I haven't done it for a while. But I always play your big hit when it goes down the storm.
Shit, well, there's the only hit. Thank you. Thanks
you know what? It's a good one. It's a good one. And most of the time, he does better versions of people's songs, but I think you're better than Tom John Jones' version. But how great was he? Tom Jones to do your song. I like to hear him singing Pretty Bacon.
Yeah, cheers, man. That's really kind. That is now my ringtone. Glenn Matlock singing Unbelievable, man. Yeah. Thank you.
Unbelievable, isn't it?
Milfredo, you guys got a DJ together.
It's done deal. I thought he said yes. I'm sure he said yes.
I want to book that. I want to be the agent on that one.
Glenn, I have a question for you, if you don't mind. This is Colin. I wanted to ask you, you know, when you released the Nevermind the Bollocks, Here's the Sex Pistols album, did you have any sense, though, when you were, let's say, when you were involved in writing the songs and stuff like that, that it was going to leave such a big mark historically?
Well, yeah, but hang on, before you go too far, a lot of that was done after I left. I was in the touring band, I contributed a hell of a lot to the songs, but I'd already left by the time that album came out, so I think we all thought we had something special, and we was going to put the cat amongst the pigeons, and it already happened around again in the UK when it came out, and it caused a stir. I am surprised people are still talking about it 45 years after the event, but I'm not complaining.
Were you prepared for the public's reaction to it? Was that something that you even thought about, or was it just...
I don't know. I mean, personally back then, you didn't really... You know, you're in a band, you think it's a bit of a goldfish bowl. I didn't really see past the end of the week then, because you don't really do when you're 18, 19, going on 20. But we didn't think we had something, so... Yeah, it was the right thing at the right time by the right people in the right trousers.
I remember it all. We think about the Sex Pistols and the Chelsea Hotel. That's our reference in New York. But we're hearing now there's a mini series in the work that Danny Boyle is doing called Pistol. And it's based on the memoir of Steve Jones from the Sex Pistols. So, and I heard that Christian Lees is playing you, which is interesting because he also played Jerry Lee Lewis in Sun Records. So that's kind of cool. Did you get involved at all in consulting on the production?
Yeah, I went and met Danny. There was another guy going to play me originally, but he got a gig in Game of Thrones, and then Christian came on board, and I met up with both of them. And Tom Christian was a good lad. He was a proper musician.
Oh, I think he's a great choice, yeah.
Yeah, he wasn't a bass player, but he liked to play bass, but he could play drums and piano. He kind of had some musical background. Yeah, and I thought he was quite simpatico. So I went down a few times. Yeah, I'm not heavily involved in it. I'm sort of once removed from it, but I was consulted. I think Danny has assured me they're going to try and do everybody justice. We'll see. It's all shot, and it's supposed to be coming out early-ish next year.
Yeah.
We'll see. But the only thing with these things is, you know, if it comes across as a quasi-documentary and it isn't really exactly right, you know, people who don't know the true story might believe something that isn't quite true. So I don't know. Wait and see. I haven't seen it yet, so I don't know. You know, reports have been good. But somebody's idea of what is true to you is not necessarily the idea of what your idea is true to you. Mm. So we'll see.
Yeah, but I'm sure there are a lot of there's a lot more material than 6 hours could cover. I'm sure there's a lot that could be done on this subject.
But it's not really. It's not only about the band. It's about Steve's life. You know. You know, and then there was that court case thing. And since it was Steve's band in the first place, I thought it was ridiculous that he shouldn't be allowed to tell his life story. You know?
Everybody has their own point of view.
Yeah.
I mean, would you ever think of writing something about that?
Well, I did a book 20 years ago before everybody, you know, now it's the thing everybody writes about their life. But the only book that I was really a reference point for me when I wrote mine 20 years ago, which is funny enough called I Was a Teenage Sex Pistol. I Was a Teenage Sex Pistol because I was.
Yeah.
I referenced Ian Hunter's Diary of a Rock and Roll Star, which is kind of good. But since I did my book, loads of people have read books.
Yeah.
You should check that out. It's good. You can get it on Amazon.
I'd love to see it. Yeah, I'll look for it. For sure.
And it's in its fifth or sixth edition now. So
that's great. And during lockdown, we heard you were with Earl Slick. Was that by choice, or did you? How did you wind up together during lockdown?
We've been touring over here, and then we got locked down. And I was supposed to be going to the States. I was going to open up just some solo shows. Open up for Dropkick Murphys on St. Patrick's Day in Boston, which could have been good. I met those guys. I did a tour.
Yeah.
Europe with them a few years back, and then I had a whole bunch of shows lined up in Canada and up and down the East Coast of America, and then I was going to go to New York and sit in on the mixing of the new album that I'd made just before lockdown, which I was on as well.
Wow.
So I've got a brand new album in the can, which is going to come out early in the new year, and I've just signed the Universal Records on that, which is I'm quite excited about, which is not bad at the age of 65 and this anyway, so I couldn't do any of that. And we just finished her and Al stayed over, and he was there for quite a few months, and we had quite a good double act going that would knock Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon into a cocktail, you know, and we did think it, we're all talk ready, but my flat needed decorating. I got a load of paint the day before lockdown happened, we was shut down, and it was just sitting there in the hallway, and I said, come on, Al, let's do this, and we kind of never got round to it. We thought, instead of doing some gigs, it might be better to do a live stream of me and him up the ladder painting the same, arguing about it. That would have been a rock and roll adventure. But
yeah.
we never got it together.
And you did it.
Glenn, tell us a little bit about Cooking You. This was something you recorded during lockdown, or...?
No, we recorded that about 3 or 4 years ago, and it came out about 3 years ago for a Good To Go album. We recorded it in upstate New York, actually, in Rhinebeck, a place called Clubhouse Studios. That was like this, one of the slower ones on the album. I wanted to make a bit more of a slightly American-sounding album for some reason. But that is my tribute to Screaming Jay Hawkins. In the song, I Put a Spell on You, he's got a great line, I don't care if you don't want me, I'm yours. Anyway, yes, I thought, right, okay. Yeah. Yeah, so that's where that's kind of coming from.
Yeah, no, I love that bluesy on that guitar. Oh my God, Earl's so cool. I love what you guys did. But let's go backwards, actually, for my question to like 1978, The Rich Kids.
Oh, yeah.
I was just hoping you could give me a little bit of insight on The Ghosts of Princes and Towers. It's such a kind of a hard to come by track. It's one of my favorites, actually. I was just wondering what inspired it.
When I was getting the band together, Mitchell was going to be in the band, and then he was, and then he wasn't, and then he was, and then he wasn't. And I thought, oh, I'm going to kind of get on with it. And I did a few gigs, and I got Mick Jones to play guitar with me.
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
He did about six shows, and I had to go then. And we played this place called The Vortex, which was just up the road from the Marquee. And somebody wrote a review of the band. And just to be a bit different, I didn't want to be like a bog standard kind of punk. And Mick always liked Keith Richards. We'd thrown our hair a little bit, and Steve knew never got his hair cut. And we sort of had sort of, not, we just had like shirts on, really, you know, like maybe slightly frilly. And so we didn't really look like punks. And somebody wrote a review of the band saying that we came on stage looking like the ghosts of the princes in town. Now, I thought, that's kind of interesting. I didn't quite know what it meant. But around about that time, there was a lot of violence between different kind of cliques of people. And the Teddy Boys were chasing the punks, and the punks were chasing the mods, and the mods were chasing the skinheads, and everybody, to try and be forward-looking, was going around saving people's heads in, and I didn't think that was quite right. In fact, when Slim Jim Phantom came over, he told me, but the Stray Cats, they came over like really late 70s, early 80s. He said they couldn't believe that all these tribes were fighting, and he said he always thought it should just be the hipsters versus the squares, you know?
Right.
Lyrically, I'd been reading John Cocteau, he was a filmmaker and wrote some books, and he wrote a book called Les Enfants Terribles about these people who go about life in a certain kind of way. And all those ideas came together in my head, and Steve New came up with a fantastic beginning riff and another bit, and it got me going, and I turned it into that song. So, but really, it's about trying to be forward-looking without being, you know, an aardvark, really, you know, without treading on people's toes. But, yeah.
I love hearing that backstory, how you've taken some journalist's slight and turned it into a piece of art. Glenn, we have to have you back on the show, and because there's so much more to talk about with you.
But, I could borrow a pencil of anybody for several hours. Don't worry about that.
We're going to have to bring you back, but our guest tonight, who you've befriended now, and not just befriended, but you've actually recorded one of his favorite songs, I believe. What's going on with Derwood?
I don't know if it was a favorite song, but what happened was, after we interviewed him, I was, to my shock and surprise, he had contacted you saying that I needed to listen to this group that he mentioned that was one of his favorite soul groups. And I went to go listen, and apparently he loved the tone of my voice and had a similar tone to the singer that he loved. And so he reached out and said, I have this song that's been sitting in my catalog, and it didn't really belong on an album, but I'd like to have you sing on it. And my first thought was that he just wanted me to do backups or harmonies on it. And so when I responded, he said, no, I want you to treat this like it's your song. And it was just a demo on a cassette. So he actually re-recorded the guitar and the drums for me, and even recorded it twice, because the first time was not quite the right key for what he wanted from my voice. And so we re-recorded it twice to get the song the way he wanted it. And he was quite happy with it at the end. So I was thrilled.
So what song? What's the song? Who's the
band? It's called Why. And he is playing amazing guitar on it, of course.
And I actually think we have a mix of it. I think we can play some of this.
Oh, really? Oh, yep. Cool.
I think we're going to play some of this. All right, Milfredo. My God, Lisa, the pipes, your voice on that track is absolutely mind-blowing. Of course, Derwood Slide. Oh, my God, is that beautiful. I'm going to use a Vinx term. That is delicious. That is some gourmet blues. Thank you for sharing that.
Glad you're here. So grab a drink. Let's have a conversation about music and sing. Oh,
tonight you joined us because we have a friend of yours on stage, and we're celebrating the life of this person. Paula, let's tell Glenn, let's tell the audience who is the main event tonight.
Today's guest is Derwood Andrews.
Way, Derwood!
Derwood has been based in California for many years, but his music career actually began in London. Back in 1976, when he was spotted performing at a gig in London by punk rocker Billy Idol, who asked Derwood to join him in a band he was just forming called Generation X.
Oh my God.
Very exciting times. As a rock guitarist, singer and songwriter, Derwood has been making music as part of bands such as Generation X, Empire, Westworld, Moondog, Speed Twin, and in his solo project called Tone Poet. One of these projects involves our guest host today. In 1996, Derwood Andrews and Glenn Matlock and Gary Twin and Ratscabies formed a band called Dead Horse. Derwood also played guitar on several tracks on Glenn's solo album, whose he thinks he is when he's at home. Derwood has written, played and sung in multiple genres of music, including rock, punk rock, pop punk, post-punk, indie rock, rockabilly, blues and alternative country. In 2007, Derwood released his first solo album called Tone Poet, followed by an album of cover songs a few years later. Then in 2013, Derwood switched from the electric guitar to playing the lap steel guitar and released an American blues album called Tone Poet Volume 2. Songs from his Generation X days have been synced on shows such as Tell Me Your Secret, The Umbrella Academy, Sex Education, Riverdale and Glow. And I had a little quote here from Henry Rollins, who said, "From the early days of punk, Derwood emerged as one of the best guitar players and songwriters from a genre that called out rock and roll and saved it from boring itself to death." Let's welcome Derwood to the stage.
Welcome, Derwood. Welcome very much to the Sync Report. How are you?
Glenn, you sound so common, mate. Well, hang on. Look, you've been stuck in the desert there for donkey's years. And I can say pretty much the same about you.
Yeah. Well, you haven't heard me speak yet.
I did. Just the way you said you sound so common, mate. How you doing? You all right?
I'm doing better than QPR, yeah.
We're fifth in the championship, so I'm not complaining. Somebody told me that in September, I would have bitten their ankle.
Let's start at the beginning of the story. Derwood, this is Colin. Nice to meet you. Yeah. Thanks a million for coming on the Sync Report.
Love your work.
Thanks. Well, I just wanted to start by saying, how did you get into playing the guitar? Were there instruments around the house?
We were a totally unmusical bunch as a family. But my cousin had a cheap Russian acoustic that I borrowed one summer. And he showed me the three chords of rock and roll. I guess I was about eight, nine, ten, something like that. Just sort of plonked around on it. I think my mum bought one for herself, and I kind of waylaid that. Yeah, just, you know.
Dude, is that the guitar that you took a knife and carved Gibson in the in the headstock?
How do you know that?
Hey, we've done our research, my friend.
I've still got that in the closet, yeah.
No! Oh, wow. So cool.
You could drive a bus under the action. It's horrible. Yeah, my cousin showed me, and I had this record player. Glenn probably had one too, that went down to 16 RPM.
Oh, I never had one of them.
Oh, well, I was privileged, I guess.
I didn't know you could get that.
Yeah. And then what was the idea of that? Just slowed it down half of 33, you know. So you put an album on. I could sit there and work out what the fuck people are doing, like Paul Kossoff and Mick Ronson, you know. So I tune my guitar down to it, figure out what they're doing. Oh, they're hammering there. Oh, they're doing this, they're doing that. And pretty much self-taught myself, and then tuned up the guitar, put it at 33. And all of a sudden, I was playing stuff I didn't think I could do, you know?
Derwood, this is Rose. Who were your influences growing up?
The man, Bo Diddley, was a huge influence. And my dad used to work at a college, and he had access to all these albums in the library. He'd bring home all this stuff that I'd never heard of at the age of, like, 14, 15. I guess I had a very broad education on what was great performances and music, like Iron Butterfly and Big Boy Arthur Crudup, just stuff like that wasn't really mainstream.
Yeah,
you could learn so much from it, of arrangements and how music worked and all that. And of course, my sister, who was an original skinhead, lived upstairs, and she would be playing Tamla Motown and Scar and all that, and Chairman of the Board. And I heard it coming through the ceiling, and as soon as she went out, I'd go up and steal her records. And,
yeah.
You know, especially Chairman of the Board and Invictus acts.
Yeah.
Their playing and the arrangements and the actual recording was just amazing. And all that stays with you, doesn't it, Glenn?
It does. You know, you've name-checked quite a few people there that were kind of big for me already, you know, Arthur Bigfoot cut up and Iron Butterfly, that was always in the sixth form pack.
Yeah.
I had a great sampler record that was called Son of Gutbucket, right? And they had all these bands on it that I would never have really investigated, but like the Al Cooper's Blues Experience, the Groundhogs, Captain Beefheart in a track, and then Ainsley Dunbar's Retaliation with this fantastic track called Sugar on the Line. But it was a whole different thing. And I think I was probably just a bit too young to be involved in that stuff. You know, it was like a tail end of the 60s, early 70s kind of thing.
Right.
And, you know, there were more slightly alternative bands. Not really, I wouldn't say they were like progressive rock things, you know, like, I don't know, Jethro Tull or something like that. But it was something different from, you know, one of the main bands that I was going on about when I actually ended up playing. It's a face, that was the big thing that got me into music. But when I got their first album, or the first album I got there, it was Long Player, they're doing some of Big Bill Bramsey song, you know, so you investigate that. And it's like,
exactly.
It's like being on the internet, you know, you follow something and you end up going down this kind of rabbit hole of different things, but hopefully you learn something as you go along. You know?
But I wonder if people still do that. Do they research where the original idea came from?
Do you know what? I think they do a bit. My kids are in bands and they're quite hip to a lot of stuff that surprises me sometimes, you know, and they do a gig. And they say,
good to hear.
A T-Rex song. And I was like, well, where did you get T-Rex from? You know, oh, well, we sort of followed the link on this thing. So I think people still do it if they've got an open mind about things, you know.
Exactly, exactly.
But the other thing, you were talking about your dad turning you on to music. I mean, I grew up in a household where my mum and dad were probably a bit older than your dad, but they loved big band music.
Yeah,
I thought it was a bit square at the time. But looking back, I'm so pleased that I know about Glenn Miller and R.T. Shaw and Benny Goodman. That's fantastic. You know, the lineup is amazing.
Can I ask you, because when we read a lot about this stuff here in America, and it seemed like the early American rockers and certainly the blues and the jazz and everything from America greatly influenced a lot of the great rock and roll people from Great Britain. And how did that come about? Was it as simple as having these records around, or is there a greater significance to that?
I think we had great radio back then, like pirate radio stations that were all in the sea and would broadcast illegally. And they played some music that you just wouldn't hear on Radio 1.
Right.
Right, it wasn't radio
back then,
was it? That's why they did it, but yeah.
Yeah, but it was just amazing. You'd go to bed with your transistor radio and a show would start at 11 o'clock or something. You'd be under the covers sneaking to listen. It was a lot of American music. Unfortunately, Americans ignored. Probably, and I don't want to get political here, but probably due to the colour of their skin.
Right.
Even down to Jimi Hendrix, he had to come to London.
Exactly,
to
the UK.
Yeah.
And I think the English are probably the most miserable people on earth. And the blues, you know, they can relate to the blues.
Right.
Just as well as they relate to punk rock. It's all, you don't feel as miserable on your own if someone else is telling you they're miserable too.
That's a good point. But another, just going on from, you know, what came soon after the pirate radio stations, I think we probably, and Del is a little bit younger than me, I think, and I'm sure he'll be hip to this, but we had the best TV show ever called Ready, Steady, Go. And all the bands that we're talking about, you know, the early Kinks and the Yardbirds and the Stones and the Beatles and the Small Faces all played the show live, the Animals. But then Dusty Springfield was on it quite a lot. And she pretty much discovered Tunnel of Motown and introduced it and made them.
Yeah, she was.
On Ready, Steady, Go, people like the Supremes and Martha Eve and the Vandellas, and Junior Walker and the All-Stars. And they'd be playing live, you know. It was fantastic. Right. So it gave us a real breadth of different kinds of music. And then what did we do with it? Invented punk rock.
What were the roots of punk rock? Was it an amalgam of all of that?
It's quite a broad church, but if I hadn't listened to what I'd listened to, even though it was kind of simple and rudimentary, you wouldn't have had Anarchy in the UK, God Save the Queen, or Pretty Baker musically, because there's all that in there somehow. You know, it's a very rich stew, and I'm sure, you know, what Derwood brought to Generation X back then. You know, and I remember when Derwood played on a couple of tracks for me, and he said to me, what do you want it to sound like? I said, Paul Kossoff. And he went straight ahead and did it. You know, you knew what page was on.
The hairs stood up on my arms when I hear that. It's just beauty personified. It is. As a musician, it's like, oh my God.
Absolutely, and one of the best voices as well.
Oh, hell yeah, man. Yeah. And the best bass player. Sorry, Glenn. But Andy Fraser.
You know what? I went to school with his brother. And I think Andy had been in there a couple of years above me. No, Andy Fraser's great.
I mean, he wrote All Right Now at the age of 15. I mean, come on.
Oh, my God.
Oh, All Right Now. That's
Jesus. You know?
And his brother was a good footballer and he played for England schoolboys.
Wow. What DNA in that family.
Yeah.
In Paula's introduction, she had mentioned Billy approaching you. Could you illuminate that moment for us and how you got started in Generation X?
We had a dreadful school band and we didn't even know. We were always like, why do we sound so weak? You know, what are we doing wrong? And it was because we didn't have a bass player. Mm. We had two guitarists and a drummer. We finally got this guy who said he'd play bass. And we thought, well, let's just put a show on where we rehearsed, which was a church crypt in Fulham. So my mate went out there and printed up tickets and we didn't think anything of it. It was a hobby. And we didn't know any songs. We had three songs and two of them were Johnny B. Goode. So we played. Everyone thought that they found these tickets going round King's Road and all that. And they thought we were a new punk band called Paradox. So we thought there'd be about...
And that was a real bander?
Well, not really, no. I mean, it was a fun thing to do at the weekend, you know?
Right.
So we set up this show and we thought about 10 people would show up, you know, out of pity for us. And like 300 punks turned up and trashed the place and trashed our gear. We all ran in the dressing room and locked the door and got drunk. And when we opened the door and everyone had fucked off, this guy came up to me and said, oh, really like your guitar. Do you want to audition for me? And at first, I've said it before, but I'll say it again, I thought he was going to whack me in the face, you know, because he looked kind of mean until he spoke and I could hear that Bromley accent. And I kind of went, oh, he's all right. And so the next day I went for the audition and I passed that. 6 days later, we're playing to the same fuckers who were beating up all my gear, but they love me. It's
like, incredible. Man. Unbelievable. 1976, a week after joining the band, you're already playing gigs.
6 days, man.
Unbelievable.
Wow. Yeah. But, you know, they weren't hard songs to learn. It was just a feeling.
So how long was it after that gig at Central London College of Arts and Design? Yeah. How after that gig did you actually get signed to Chrysalis?
Oh, it was almost a year, I think.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it was a long time. And to be honest, it was the best time because no one knew what they were doing. We were just a band having fun, being young and not giving a shit. And then as soon as we hooked up with the corporate world, it all changed.
So did you feel that when your generation went into the charts, was there like a different atmosphere around the band?
No, not then, because that was all brand new, you know. And like Glenn said, I was a little bit too young for the Ready, Steady, Go show. But Top of the Pops that's where you got all your information from. And to actually appear on that was like, okay, I retire. I'm 18. I've hit my goal. Thank you.
Unbelievable. I got to just tell you, Colin Rose, I'm Milfredo. I'm in heaven at the moment. This is, you know, Derwood, you know, he hit his at 18. I'm hitting mine at 51. This is my climax right here tonight. And so the band released Generation X in 78. went to number 29 with the Valley of the Dolls. King Rocker went to 11. What's happening in your world at this moment? I mean, and we did get a chance to talk about your days before your band thing really happened for you. You're gardening for royalty and picking up different odds and bobs for jobs. But now you've become punk rock royalty. I mean, what was that feeling like?
It really, I think we're getting close to be thought of as punk rock royalty now, 45 years later.
You're humble. No,
it's true, man. I don't know about Glenn, but the most we ever made in the 3 years I was with Generation X was 30 or 40 pounds a week. So and I know the drummer, Mark, we were on the dole, getting our rent paid, trying to survive, you know? You didn't get the feeling.
Wow.
I tell you what, after doing the first Top of the Pops, I don't mean, okay, that's it, I'm done. But when you do it for the sixth, seventh time, it becomes blasé. And it becomes annoying because you've got to sit around all day at the BBC and meet people like Eric Clapton and all that. And it's like, oh, God, this is horrible. I'd rather be down the pub. So it really gets tainted. And like I say, I don't know about how Glenn felt, but it wasn't punk rock royalty. The idea of punk rock was to be the same as the audience. You know, to anyone get up and do it, it just takes a bit of courage.
I kind of agree, really.
Yeah.
Well, that was my approach to it, but I don't know if everybody else in the Pistols was like that, and you could probably work out which ones which who wasn't like that. But initially, it was like that, you know.
Yeah, initially, and then people got the taste of a little bit of attention and took it all away, you know. And that's where I think me and you both sort of went, you know what, I don't want to do this anymore. This ain't what I start.
I never said I don't want to do it anymore, but I always wanted to do it on my terms a bit more. I mean, the whole reason that I wanted to be in a band was because I didn't want to get a job. I don't mind working, but I wanted to do something quite worthwhile. But you want to be in a band because you don't want people telling you what to do. And when you end up being told what to do, it sort of takes all the fun out of it, really, you know. So
precisely.
That's the point of being an artist, though. I don't care in what, if it's, you know, like Rose and making films and Colin and making films or Picasso. You know, you guys are artists creating art, and you can't tell an artist. I think that was the big disconnect, you know, when so many bands got signed, these A&R guys turning into number crunchers. But anyways, you're having this amazing role and all the success, but you leave the band and you form Empire, which is almost a super band in its own. Can you tell us a little bit about Empire?
One album, four gigs, and we disappeared. But 45 years later, people talk about it as quite an influential album. And I think mainly because it was recorded so well by my good friend Michael Gregovich, R.I.P., it stood the test of time, and it's like a fine cheese, you know. It's been on the shelf for 45 years and people love it. I don't know why.
Yeah, it's just getting better with time.
Yeah, I think music does.
Darryl, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
What led to the Westworld project? It seemed like you started playing more Americana rockabilly style music.
By that time, I had not advanced my bank account one iota in 10 years. And I was so sick of it, struggling, you know, living in squats, blah, 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 blah. I was doing this thing with my friend and I thought it was terrible, really corny. And what I was doing I thought was really good, but it was a bit highfalutin. And people said, oh, this is great. This is really, I love this. And I thought, hang on a minute. So I think I've lost the plot here. People love inane lyrics, shitty three chords, energy, blah, blah. I should do that. So I basically stole my friend's band, changed the name, and we went off on this journey of mixing our three influences, which was me was kind of bluesy, punky, bluesy shit. Nick Burton was the drummer and the acoustic guitarist. He was Mr. Rock and Roll, like old school rock and roll.
Yeah.
And Elizabeth Westwood was the American, like, hip-hop kind of influence. So with those three things, genuine love of those three things from three different people, that's what you hear when you hear a Westworld song. It's those three elements. We just took it as far as we could on our own, you know?
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
And Westworld actually had a couple of songs synced to film, right? Banana Bamboo was in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles in 1987,
yeah, right.
And So Long Cowboy was in Point Break.
Yeah, yeah. And quite a few.
And then you did a Sony TV ad in 1987?
Well, that was nothing to do with us. They just did it.
And they just used your music.
Yeah, luckily paid us. We didn't go to them and say, hey, can we be a Christmas ad, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
We had the song. It was called Boris for Peggy Sue. And it was about, like, Boris. Who was the Boris singer at the time? I can't remember. But it was all clean and, you know, real nice, and we wanted to swap him out for Peggy Sue, and so I called it Boris for Peggy Sue. Then I woke up one morning and I said, no, Banana Bamboo. And that was it, because, you know, I love those inane lyrics, like sha-na-na-na-na, and bebop, you know, it's all that shit.
I do, and it's Milf here. You had a big influence. Did you work with Ralph Jezard with Westworld?
Yeah, I always wanted to say that, because we hung out with you guys quite a lot doing terrible things.
Yeah.
and I do remember you guys being very nice. We got on well.
Yeah, and, yeah, definitely, I did too.
And, Ralph, I think just before your song came out, Ralph started doing our album.
Yeah.
And what a great guy. Great.
He needs this. But you made an impression on him. I think he kept that quiff for the rest of his life, I think, after doing the rockabilly stuff.
Yeah.
He loved it. He loved that scene, didn't he?
We had such a good time, you know, that whole crew. I think we all went camping once as well. It was really good.
Yeah, it was, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was great.
It's all distant memories, and it's just like, I remember when Jason said originally, he was like, and I was just like, yeah, we definitely hung out with them. I'm sure we did, you know, and it's just like, yeah, yeah, it's good. But Ralph was a good catalyst, wasn't he, for everybody? He was just a good guy, and you knew that if people like Ralph, they were good people, and that was kind of what worked around him, I think.
All right, so finally, we're going to move from Westworld to Moondog, which was the period of time Ratty introduced us. And I actually, as I'm thinking back on the moment, I remember sitting between you, Rat, and Raven from Killing Joke at the Lava Lounge.
Bless him.
And thinking to myself, like, I felt it was so surreal. It couldn't be happening, you know? It was like all of my heroes I'm having drinks with right now. And we started talking about this tribute that I was doing with Miles Copeland and Jack Healy for Human Rights. And that was my first introduction to Moondog. And the reason why Moondog has a double G is because of an R&B artist named Swamp Dog.
Right.
Who you actually grew up listening to, befriended, and came in the studio and made this track for this tribute to Eleanor Roosevelt. What was it like recreating a hero of yours and actually producing him in the studio?
Well, first of all, I've got to say the reason I ever met him is because of you, Jason. Because you came up to me and you said, if you could work with anyone, who would you want to work with? And before you finished the sentence, I said, Swamp Dog.
I remember.
Yeah, and I eventually found out through my small connections in Los Angeles that I got his number and I went to see him. You said there's some money in it and it's for a good cause, and I told him that and he was on board, you know? It was just amazing. And because the thing about, people probably haven't maybe heard of Swamp Dog, but if you go and check him out all the way back.
Everybody has sampled that guy. Yeah, this is the thing.
Well, not only that, but there is an intelligence and a sense of humor in everything he does. And it's a real rare quality in music to have that, to be funny while you're making a point that is not funny at all.
No.
And that's why I loved him. I consider myself being his guitarist for about 4 or 5 years. you know, we toured Europe and...
Oh, wow.
Did a lot of stuff, yeah, yeah.
Tell me a little bit more about Moondog then.
Well, Moondog, Westworld lost their record deal and we didn't know what to do, but I was still writing. And then along came this record company, had a ton of money. They said, where do you want to record? You know, what do you want to do? We said, we want to go live in America. So they paid for that. We didn't want to be in LA, so we moved to a little town called Cave Creek in Arizona. Yeah. And that's a book in itself.
Is this the place where you rode a horse into a bar?
So they say. I can't quite remember. Yeah. It was a 3-year party. Eventually, it was just me and Elizabeth left there. And we thought we'd change the name to Moondog. And we went back to London for a bit and we got involved in the early drum and bass scene with a guy called Martin Lee Stevenson, one of the original guys.
Yeah.
And what we did, we took my songs that I'd recorded there, all slide guitar stuff, you know, because I'm in the desert. And he, first thing he did, he came around and he blew my speakers up. And I thought, oh, I get it. You know, with drum samples and basses that really were blowing up the desk. And he basically took the multi-tracks of what I'd done as you know, bluesy songs in Cave Creek, and he made it all new and jungly, you know, and which was great. Trouble was, nobody knew what the hell it was because jungle was not even started, really.
Well, this is the thing. I remember being in the studio when you were doing Synthetic World, and then you invited me to the house. You were actually in Hollywood at the time, and you had all this gear. I mean, I was like, I remember I had just bought my DAT machine, right? Remember those?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
You had all this electronical gear set up in the living room and right. Doing all of this mental. I'd never seen anything like it at the time. It was so ahead of anybody listening. You should definitely have to check out what Moondog was doing. Incredible, incredible.
It was all made on Atari game computers. That's what everyone was using. It was the ST whatever's. It was, you know, S900 samplers, Atari computer, and it was just a new world. And I found that that was the main equipment that all of these young kids were using to create jungle and samples and all that stuff. And we just merged the two things, bluesy and jungly. I think it's yet to be, that's on the shelf maturing as well.
I'm telling you, because in the spring, I have 3 films I'm starting, and oh my God, are we going to be harvesting that music?
Oh, good.
So after that, Darren, how did you end up connecting again with Rats Gabies and Glenn and Gary Twin for the Dead Horse Band?
I was on a tourist visa, so I had to go home every 12 weeks. You know, it's like, oh, Jesus. Mm-hmm. And I'd stay there for a month, and while I was there, it would be like, go round Rats and make a record, or, you know, let's get a band together, and then I'd leave again. So over those mid-90s, I would say, it was all about music. It always is about music. Like, I don't know if Glenn's still there. Are you, Glenn?
I'm here. I'm getting hungry, though, but I am listening. It's all interesting stuff.
Yeah, well...
I'm going to have my fish pie soon, but yeah, go on. I thought I'd wait to the Dead Horse thing, because I want to know a bit more about Dead Horse. I didn't quite understand what it was. It was fun.
That's all I was going to say. It was like, oh, we all love music. Let's make some music. And Rat had that, the Arches.
Yeah, yeah, the fantastic studio underneath Kew Bridge, which was a great place. Drake didn't manage trying onto it. But yeah, he had a space. He didn't really know what to do with himself. So he was like inviting people down. And I think we all respected each other.
Do you guys want to hear a bit of Never Satisfied?
Oh, yeah, man.
Milfredo. Stop your dreams. Yeah. What was the energy like recording that?
I think, like Glenn said, we were all professionals and we respected ourselves, each other. It was just like, let's make some music. And that's what came out. Unfortunately, there's only about six tracks, so it's not an album. And what do you do with six tracks?
Yeah. And the thing was that nobody was in the same place at the same time. I mean, yeah, it was when we recorded it, but Gary was going to the States. I was probably off trying to do something else, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it's always been a bit of a problem with people of our pedigree and age group. You know, people grow up, they kind of have different lives and things, and it makes it harder to get that great band together. You might have all the right people on paper, but you can't. Do you know what? One of the things I'm most proud of, but nothing ever happened of it, was that Mick Ronson called me up, and I met Mick Ronson through working with the Rich Kids, in producer Rich Kids. And we got on pretty well. I'm a friend of his family and stuff. And he called me up, you know, in the 80s. He wasn't doing a lot. He said, I think I'm forming a band. I said,
oh, wow.
Who are you going to get? And he said, well, I was thinking of getting Paul Rogers, asking him. And I went, yeah. And Simon Kirk on drums. And I said,
oh, my God.
And I said, who are you going to get on bass? He said, well, you, of course. And I went, well. So I said, he said, would you be up for it? And I said, yeah. So Mick Ronson, who's one of the most fantastic people, guitarists ever, and a great bloke, called up Paul Rogers. But Paul Rogers had just started doing this other thing. And then Simon Kirk wasn't available. But Simon said, maybe Kenny Jones. And I love Kenny Jones. And Mick wasn't too keen on his playing. And it didn't happen. It was a great idea, but nobody was available.
Wow.
And I was just like, I don't think I've ever really told anybody that. But I was just chuffed being younger than those guys to be asked to do it. It's the same for those people as it was for us. You know, you're not always in the same place or in the right headspace at the right time. Could have been good. It could have been dreadful. Yeah. But
or dreadfully good.
So when did you guys actually meet?
Who?
You and Glenn.
I don't know. I can't remember.
Not really. I remember having a jam down at the Sunday school once with Tony Barber and some other bloke.
Probably like that, yeah.
That was probably the first time we chatted, but I was, of course, aware of you, you know. I don't want to blow smoke up your backside, but, you know, out of the whole punk thing, there's loads of people who play guitar, but they couldn't really play guitar, they just strummed along. And I thought about the whole British punk thing. There was only two really good lead guitar players, and that was Steve New and Del, you know, and they were both adventurous lead players who had a whole load of other stuff that they'd obviously listened to and could draw on, whereas most of the other guitarists might have gone back as far as the New York Dolls or the Art Breakers, you know, and it wasn't enough.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Steve used to play for the London East Jazz Orchestra and play all these Charlie Christian riffs and stuff like that, you know.
Right.
And we had all that kind of free thing and other stuff going on. And it makes a difference. I don't think there's many kind of really good punk lead guitarists, maybe Williamson a little bit. I really dug Robert Quine and the Voidoids, but that's about it, really. I can't think of any.
Drew, well, tell us about Madeline.
I wrote it about my friend's little daughter called Madeline. I just love the name, and it's a good thing to say in a song, you know, Madeline, Madeline. It was with Speed Twin, and at the time we had a stand-up bass player, Mario, and Dale Daniel on drums, who was an old rockabilly drummer, still is, great guy. Me and Gary, yeah. We just wanted to do something really fast, country.
And fun. You know? Yeah, let's hear it. Let's, Milfredo, play a bit of Madeline.
It was a dirty thing to do. It wasn't me, it wasn't you. It's over now, I'm really through. I give my heart and soul to you. I wouldn't lie, you're free to leave. I am to blame, I do believe. I took a walk so I could see and found my way back to Madeline. I took a long
And I'm going to pass it back to Colin. We're going to jump you to another genre. I think we're going to talk a bit about Tone Poet next.
you sort of touched on it earlier on about playing the lap steel guitar and being influenced by where you were. What was it like, one, to sort of start playing a lap steel, which is quite a bit different than regular guitar? And then what was it like also to do a solo project?
Horrible and horrible.
Wow.
No, really, it's really frightening. A, to be a solo project, you know, to be thought of as a singer-songwriter, it makes my hair fall out. It's like, oh, God, no. But I couldn't think of anyone else who would want to come along, you know? I'd been playing bottleneck guitar for 20 years, and then suddenly this lap steel appeared, thanks to my lovely wife, for a birthday present. It just sat in the corner, and I looked at it one day and thought, I need to get something out of this. So I just started mucking around with it and very quickly wrote a song called Coyote, recorded it, and then just carried on from there. And like you say, it's a totally different thing from guitar. A, it's laying down. B, you have no frets. C, I've said it before, but it's like asking a piano player to go play an accordion, because it's got a keyboard. Surely you can do that. It's completely different. It's another world. And it's a world that I dove into completely free and found so many things that I would never find on a normal guitar.
Mm-hmm. So, Rhett, we just played Never Satisfied. Do you remember that track? You missed a good one.
Yeah, I think so. It's the one where he sings Never Satisfied, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the one. That's the one.
Yeah. Was that the Dead Horse session?
Yeah. Dead Horse, mate.
I got really quite fond memories of that, us all just kind of being down in the arch and smelling the damp, but having a really good time while we did it.
Yeah, fantastic.
Glenn was just talking about that studio.
Yeah, it was a really great space, and I'd only just sort of started properly messing about with sound things, you know. And it was like I'd open the studio and then suddenly I had to learn how to work it. It was just so convenient, and just, you know, there was a lot of good things came out of that.
Oh, and it sounded like the place to be. Everybody was coming through those doors.
Right.
Yeah.
I remember fondly, like you do, like calling you up and saying, "Rat, I need to get a drum beat. Can you meet me down the arches?" And I come over there on the Triumph and, you know, put a thing on a fucking dictaphone or something.
Yeah.
And go home and finish the track. And it would be Moondog stuff, you know, like you were saying, God's Wallet. Rats all over the place on everything I've done, you know?
It was just such a convenient place for doing exactly that. And the thing was that a dictaphone worked just as well down there in a lot of ways as, you know, putting mics on every tom-tom and doing all of that kind of thing.
Exactly.
It was all one big learning curve, I think, for me anyway, you know, of like, well, what can you do? And then I'd be quite anal and say, well, we need noise gates on that. And Durr would have just turned up and said, no, that's all right. We'll just, that'll be fine, man. Never mind that. Here's that adds to the character.
Yeah. I think people might call it guerrilla recording.
Yeah.
I have to ask you, Rhett, you know, you're just kind of chiming in and you're joining us because you are friends for many years with Durwood. Tell me, can you remember when you guys met?
The first time I met Durwood was probably backstage at the Greyhound in Croydon. But I don't think we spoke to each other for another 15 years after that.
Yeah, very strange.
What show, his or yours?
It was a Gen X show, I think. I remember because Tony James was meditating in the dressing room.
He was always meditating.
And I thought, this is, wow, that's, you know, why would you want to do that?
He used to carry his own tissues around with him, just in case.
Did he? Well, yeah. Me and Tony sort of went back to 75, I suppose, with London SS and things. That was the first time I met him.
Yeah, right.
And doing that stuff. But, yeah.
What happened 15 years later? Why did you guys reconnect 15 years later?
I think I went to a damn gig, went backstage, and I burst in there and said, oh, great show, guys. Everyone looked at me like, who the hell was that? And Rat was the only one who spoke to me. So we kind of got a friendship up from there, I think.
Yeah, I think, you know, Slouch was a big catalyst.
Oh, yeah, always, yeah. Slouch, the lovely tech.
He was our tech too.
Oh, yeah, right, yeah. That's right.
Him and Josh. Remember Josh?
Yeah.
Josh. Was it Josh? The other guy?
Yeah. Joss.
Yeah. Lovely. Lovely.
Yeah.
But I think the thing that was good about it was that because we hadn't really done anything or met each other, we sort of, the whole competitive punk rock thing had run its course, and it was suddenly like, oh, here's a new person that.
Yeah, right.
Kind of around, you know, who I've never actually worked with before. So let's, you know, and it's kind of, you just sort of go, yeah, he's not such a bad geezer, is he? Even though he was in Gen X.
I like it.
So, Deerwood, tell me about the LP God's Wallop. I believe Rat actually played drums. Was there multiple tracks on that?
Quite a few, yeah. You know, dictaphone things. And we did a whole lot of good stuff there, particularly one track. Swamp Dog wanted me to do a load of cover versions for a film called Mod Squad because they didn't want to pay for the originals. So I had a mission to go back to London, bury my father, and get a bunch of tracks done. So I went back down to Rats and we did quite a few tracks. One of them...
Is that when you did Backstabber?
That's when we did Backstabbers.
Right, and oh wow.
With Sue Catwoman. And... I mean, that is such a great track, and people are catching on to it now. You know, it's like, and I remember specifically, Rat spent all this time putting all filters on everything and mixing it great. And then when we came to master it, all of that was muted, and we didn't realise. It was just the raw track, and it just sounds so raw. It's really good.
I think that was a lucky break in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Well, because you interfere with everything when you can, don't you?
Certainly.
Because I remember mixing with you and changing something, and you just went, that's fucked everything. And you just pulled the faders down. And it was like, actually, yeah, because when you change one thing, it changes everything, you know?
It really does, because it's only stereo, isn't it? If you mess with one thing, the balance is all out.
Yeah.
Let's listen to something from that LP. Let's listen to Nothing Sacred, Milfredo.
I let myself back out on the street. All my friends are down at my feet. And all the lost souls get in the squeeze. Nothing sacred no more.
Yeah, that's Rat Symbol, and not the bad one that makes you deaf, but the nice one. Yeah, Nothing Sacred. That was Elizabeth singing, and me playing side, and Martin Lee Stevenson, who was the jungle guy, he actually mixed all the Dead Horse stuff as well. That was his thing. He would come round, blow up your speakers, you'd mix it on headphones, and then you had a great track.
There were, just to go back to Tone Poet, you were saying that it was, you know, scary and terrifying to learn the lap, and scary and terrifying to sort of break out and do your own solo project. What was it like for you to do this solo project? What were you feeling? What was going on in your head?
I did a very sensible thing. Most of my songs are about death for Tone Poet. It's like a lot of death stuff. And I did a very sensible thing. I threw myself into the fires of hell, and I went and played. First gigs I played were in a church full of old people, and you've got to realise how quiet a lap steel is if it's not amplified. It's just an acoustic lap steel, and there I was playing songs about death in front of people with one foot in the grave. And I did that for about a year. After that, anything was fine, you know? A great introduction to not being scared anymore. But the old people loved it. I got to say also that Rat appears on the Tone Poet stuff as much as he did everything else. So,
oh, tell us about that. What did he appear on?
I think it was the last proper album was Tone Poet 4, and he plays drums on 3 or 4 tracks that we recorded out here when he was out here. So it's always an ongoing situation.
So much history together. Yeah, amazing that you guys have done so much together.
Yeah, it's, well, you stick to what you know, don't you? And you know what to expect. You know, it's not like if you get a stranger around and it's like, oh, God, why, you know, how can I get rid of them?
Or just simply going through that process of getting to know and get comfortable with somebody.
Yeah, I can't stand that anymore. I'm too old.
Never really heard Durwood play slide before.
Oh, I'm playing slide.
Oh. And we'd done the Dead Oods thing, but you were kind of very conventional on that, you know. You were like,
yeah,
it was all fingers and no bottleneck. And we did this and you did that. And that was when I sort of went, fuck me, he's good, isn't he?
So, Paula, who have we got on this week?
Well, Colin, on tonight's show, we have got Rat Scabies on the show.
Wow!
Woohoo!
Yay! Rat Scabies started his drumming career for pub rock band Tor and London SS alongside the Clashes' Nick Jones, as well as early British punk band Masters of the Backside. I don't think I've ever heard a better band name, I'll be honest, which was with Chrissie Hynde, before going on to form The Damned in 1976, with fellow London SS band member Brian James and fellow Masters of the Backside members Dave Vanian and Captain Sensible. The Damned were the first punk band in the UK to release a single, New Rose, in 1976, an album, Damned, 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 in 1977, and to tour the US. They moved to a more gothic rock style with the 4 studio albums they released in the 80s, and Rat recorded his final album with The Damned in 1995. Outside of his work with The Damned, Rat has recorded a cover version of Bob Dylan's This Wheel's on Fire as Rat and the Whale. He briefly formed a group called The Germans with Peter Coyne and Chris Dollymore, and plays drums in the punk rock supergroup The Mutants, now called 1000 Motels. In recent years, he has played with a variety of artists, including Donovan, Nosferatu, Scar artist Neville Staples, formerly of The Specials, Chris Goss, The Members, The Spammed, and Urban Voodoo Machine. In 2018, he released his solo album, PhD, Prison, Hospital, Debt. His band, Professor and the Madman, released a new album, Seance, in 2020. And in that same lockdown year, he formed a new band called The Sinclairs, launching a debut album and a couple of singles, including Pillow Fight Skies, featuring Jane Horrocks in the video.
Brilliant.
And most recently, 1000 Motels released their second album, Get In Where You Fit, in April 2021. Let's welcome Rat Scabies.
Rat Scabies!
Welcome, Rat. Welcome to the Sync Report. Thanks for coming.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Well, Rat, I wanted to ask you something. You know, The Damned obviously left their mark in the history books for punk music. Is that a style of playing? Is it still your first love, or has being involved in other projects been a nice variety for you to explore?
Well, here's the thing, is when I started playing, I just wanted to be a drummer, and I never, ever thought I'd end up in a band like The Damned or even make a record. I was expecting to kind of end up in an orchestra pit or doing something like that. And for me, The Damned turned up and I did that, and it was kind of like, but this isn't all that it's about. You know, when you play, you kind of always want to progress and you want to try and move forward and get better, because you're always surrounded by people that know more than you.
Yeah,
totally. You know,
it's like even now I watch YouTube and I see so many drummers on there and musicians, I'm just like, fuck, how do they do that? You know, and it's kind of, so there's always a level that you want to achieve because you know other people have got there before you and you want to kind of catch up. It was kind of nice doing, you know, like the Donovan tour, because it was very stretching for me to have to kind of go into reverse gear as to everything I'd got used to doing.
But you know, Rad, the reason, the way, so that's a funny story. I'm so glad you actually mentioned Donovan, because Donovan had just done, he released a new album after umpteen years called The Beat Cafe, actually a beautiful, his ode to his love for jazz. And I had actually, Durwood had actually played me a Backstabber, a few tracks he had just done with Rat. And in that series of recordings was you, Rat, doing Sin, Sin, Sin. Like the most amazing Benny Goodman version I've ever heard of that track. It blew my mind. And I played that to Donovan saying, hey, what do you think of this jazz drummer, Chris Meller? And he played, and he goes, oh my God, this guy's phenomenal. Get him on the road. And I think it was, you know, it wasn't until rehearsals where Donovan fully clocked on that he actually had the damn drummer backing him on this tour. It was actually amazing.
You know, he'd never call me Rat.
Chris, it was always Chris.
It was always Chris, yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, what was really nice about that for me was that he wouldn't introduce me as Rat Scabies or anything on stage. And we used to have that bit where everybody used to do a bit of a solo and the people would applaud, you know. But what was really nice about it was I got the applause because it was Chris Miller and not because I was part of The Damned. You know, The Damned always got applause because it was the band. It was a kind of, it was a sum total of individuals. You know what I mean?
It's a legacy that you created. It's
But it never really felt like, you know, the applause isn't yours individually. But with Don doing that and the way he used to introduce everything, it actually, that was kind of the first time I went, oh, actually, yeah, you know, people kind of think I'm good enough to put their hands together and put their drinks down for a minute, you know?
Oh, that's so lovely. We're going to share this with Donovan. He'll love that.
Rat, I wanted to sort of skip on a little bit and ask you, tell me what the writing process was like for the album Seance with the Professor and the Madman project.
You know, they're kind of stuck in California, really. And it's their show, you know, they kind of write everything. And I end up with really just a backing track and I just kind of sit there and do my thing on it, you know. It's a loneliness of the long-distance drummer.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because I wasn't really... I guess I was in the band because I did, I think, 3 or 4 albums in some ways, but we only did one live show and stuff because it was just such a big physical distance, you know, the thing of they have their lives over there and technology today just lets me kind of go into a studio and I can, you know, put the drums down and they'll have those tracks on their computers before I get home. Mm-hmm. So it kind of works, but I think it works because it's quite instinctive what they do, because I like their writing and I like them as people and I like the songs they write. So it's kind of quite easy to fall in with it. But as far as writing the album goes, I really didn't have much to do with it at all.
Because I played with them once as well. And what I found, I didn't know them at all. And I just turned up to play and at this gig. And they're just such nice people. Really, really nice people. And, of course, being American, they're all fantastic players. And that's something you don't really find in England, is fantastic players and nice people.
Let's skip from The Professor. Let's skip to 1,000 Motels. What's the story behind the name? And can you give us a little bit of insight of who was involved with that project?
1,000 Motels was sort of born out of the Mutants. And the Mutants was quite a blatant crack at commercial success, you know, because the idea of the Mutants was, for example, the first album was a London record and a very English kind of thing with, I don't know, just like Neville and Charlie Harper and Beck and Bondage. And the idea was that as the Mutants was unknown, if we got a famous singer for every song, and their fans would probably buy a few copies, and that way we could make maybe sell some more records. So then the second album we did was a Tokyo record, and we went over there, and it was like Shonen Knife and Guitar Wolf and people like that. And then the third one we did was the Joshua Tree, you know, Desert album. And that kind of carried on the same way. We just get local celebrities to play on the records because it was a sort of way of reaching a bigger audience. And then we kind of got a bit sort of fed up with being stuck with that because you couldn't take it on the road or do anything.
Oh, right.
To promote it. So Chris Constantinou, the bass player, and I decided that we'd kind of, you know, plod on our own steam and see how we got on with that, which is, you know, why we changed the name to 1000 Motels.
Brilliant.
And, you know.
Tell me about the song Temptation.
That was another credit with
I mean, this is the thing, the intersections.
Me, Dahoud, and Sean have always thought we're a super group that really all in the same place at the same time. And one day we will be.
Well, you guys are my super group, that is for sure. And honestly, a dream come true for me. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thanks so much, Rat.
Oh, you're welcome.
And thanks so much, Derwood.
Thank you, Colin.
It's been great talking to everybody. Rat, been good to have a proper chat another time. Yeah. So the same with you, Derwood, as well. And thank you very much for inviting us on. It's been good. There's been a whole load of stuff that went on behind my back I didn't know about, but now I do. So thank you. All right, ladies. All right,
thanks, Glenn. Thanks,
Glenn.
Right,
anyway, guys. Let's all catch up.
Bye. See you, Glenn.
Goodbye.
Paula, what's your favourite show so far?
My favourite? It's hard to say, really. Steve Binder, I think. What's yours?
Well, Edge and I, we like Jackie Martling's, I think, for the jokes, you know. Right, Edge?
Jackie Martling?
Do you use Apple Podcasts or Spotify?
Both, because we need the numbers.
Edge uses our website. Right, Edge?
The website, 2 Cents Music. Yeah, yeah.
Don't you love that site? So many cool images and things to check out.
Yeah, so cool. I haven't checked it out yet. Maybe next week I'll give it a go.
Yeah, well, I'm going to be cool like Edge and Paula and go there right now. 2centsmusic.com, developed by Blaster Web Services.
Sync opportunities, sync opportunities.
This is Rat's first time on Clubhouse, so...
Hey, he's on stage.
You made it.
Wow, excellent. And there you are.
Hi, Rat.
Well, hi. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm just doing a couple quick introductions, and then I'm turning this entire show over to Don and the Sinclairs. A couple quick introductions, and then we're going to get into music. Let's introduce our guest panelist, Christine Kreska, the beautiful,
Hello.
The brilliant, the talented. Hello, my angel.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm excited to be here. Thank you for including me.
I am so excited for you to be here. This woman is so brilliant, a filmmaker. She knows about animation. She knows about music, fashion. She is the coolest woman I've met in umpteen years. I say it's time for music. Let us say hello to our featured guest tonight, Jesse Budd. How are you, my friend?
I'm good, thanks, Jason. How are you?
Oh, it's great to hear your voice. So I was saying, you know, I was actually introduced to you and Joe through Rat when he was producing Flip Ron's first album.
No, I remember meeting you. It was up in Rat's attic.
You're right. Yep. And we hung out at that. In fact, I was just fantasizing about being in that pub and having a drink with Rat. God, I miss those days. So tell me, Jesse, how did you reconnect with Rat? Where did the idea for the Sinclairs come from?
You know, we've never sort of unconnected, really, I suppose. We're just talking about music, as it were, and I was thinking about the way Rat plays, and I was thinking about what's a great vehicle to hear Rat playing the drums. I was listening to old records. I was listening to Diamonds by Jet Harris and Tony Meehan, and they did this fantastic instrumental, Diamonds, and it's just full of drums and loud, twangy guitar, and I thought, well, that's kind of the way I play. I was thinking there's a load of room for Rat on that, and Rat is a really, you know, if you've got the right space and a drummer that knows what to do with it, you can do something fantastic. So I said to Rat, let's do this. And then we didn't do anything for about 3 years. And then finally, we just put some songs together and it turned into the first album.
Honestly, I love that you guys have developed it the way you developed, because what you've come up with is brilliant. Don, what are we hearing first?
Hello. So nice to be here. The first one we have up is La Venta.
Let's go ahead, play the song, and then Perfect. Let's hear what's... Yeah, let's go from there.
Thank you. Heather, can you play La Venta?
Of course, coming right up.
Oh my God, what a way to start the show. Incredible. Jess Reddy, you want to tell us a little bit about that track and then we'll open up to the panel's thoughts?
Oh, you know what? The thing is, Jesse is such a strong melody. It's kind of like when you're a drummer, the golden rules are you never get in the way of the vocals or the melody line. And with the melody lines that Jess writes, I find it really easy to kind of work around that and overdo it. I think I'm probably, you know, really good value because you get more beats from me than many other drummers.
You get
the work cut out for me because really the template is in the notes and then the real fun comes in supporting that, making it bigger, better, using dynamics, but all the kind of musical stuff. But then, you know, like throwing the sort of dirty old synths and the sci-fi noises on makes it fun as well. That's kind of what I was talking about with, you know, we don't really know what we're doing, but we have a lot of happy accidents.
I'm the kind of sensible melody guy, and Rat's job is the one to push it in a direction where I had no idea it was going to go and to help it find itself in a whole new costume.
All right, look, well, let's get some feedback. I want to introduce you guys to our DJ, music supervisor, Milfredo 7 from EMF is on stage. How's it going, my friend?
Yeah, all good, mate. Yeah, we're good this end. What a way to start the show.
Oh, my God, how cool is that? That's kind of your almost stateside hombres.
Oh, I know, you can hear it. And when, you know, we're obviously with Jess in the Neville Staple, but did you play it down at Shine at Butlin's last year, Jess?
Yes.
I was there. Yeah. I came backstage with my mate Nugs.
I remember. Yes.
Yeah, we came back. That's right. But those Hammonds and that are sneaking in, it's just got, I mean, it's just lazy journalism, but it's almost a poison chalice that anything with that guitar sound, just like straight away you think, oh, Pulp Fiction. But it's more than that. Do you know what I mean? I'm being a lazy journalist.
Oh,
there,
but that's a compliment, I think.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But it's like, you know, your mind goes straight to that. But a curveball would be, imagine in a skate or snowboard video, and because there's a big shift at the moment to that kind of high eight grainy video, and that would just sit perfect. It really would, you know, just it's not nasty, but it is. It's gritty, and you've just said just now, you know, the music's alive, and it is alive, and that's so refreshing to have real drum sounds and not real sounding drums. You know, is a big difference, isn't there, between the two? And I'm a major kind of guy, and this is probably at times minor for my palate, but mate, it just ticks every box on the "it should sound like this" list. So yeah, I love it, Jess. Well done, Rat. It's great.
Excellent. What a way to start, Milfredo. Yeah, I couldn't, and I can't agree more. And I'm wondering, so let's bring up, it's funny because we have like one of the great percussionists that joins us every week. He's a phenomenal songwriter and singer. Vinx, my friend, how are you? How is France? Did you have a chance? Were you in the room long enough to hear that track?
Yeah, of course I did. My brother, it was great. I love it when you can feel the communication between the artists. It's like I usually say, they create the bed is the song, and what they do, how they decorate that bed defines who they are as artist and what the point is, what it's necessary for. So I love the lawlessness that they had, because that's true communication. Nothing was the same. I felt like I was there when it happened, and that was probably suitable for the scene that it's attached to. There's a certain truth that comes out when true musicians talk to each other.
I'm really pleased you said that, because all of the takes were live. We could have polished the whole thing up to sound like a kind of mainstream radio track or something.
Yeah, it's not a real conversation if it's all scripted.
No, exactly.
You can't answer the question until somebody asks. Right. I feel you.
Yeah, and I think that's part of what gives it atmosphere, is the fact that it does go wrong in places and it isn't perfect, because we can get perfection anytime. And perfection's really overrated, you know?
You cannot plan magic. You just got to be good enough to recognize it when you feel it and you see it. So I love that you guys were honored the craft of the communication, being fluent in your craft. Bravo.
Before we move on to the next track, we've just been joined by our final panelist, Everton Lewis Jr., who I've recently connected with. Amazing guy. Welcome to the stage. I don't know if you had a chance to hear that song.
I mean, yeah. So, I mean, as many of us music supervisors, a lot of the times, all we need to do is hear like a few seconds of a track and automatically know where it could go. But I caught the tail end of it. First thing I thought as soon as I chimed in was, yeah, you get that Pulp Fiction, Quentin Tarantino feel. But not only that, just from a music supervisor's end, it's a very easy song to sing. I even thought about like some ad stuff and like a lot of bigger brands that would really use that song to sell their brand and get their story across. I could totally see this on like one of those travel company websites, and those are big bucks too, man.
All right, so let's see if we can impress you with the next one. Don, what's up next?
Yes, sir. Man, isn't this room golden, I have to say.
Oh my God, so much
amazing.
Fun.
So the next track up from the Sinclairs is Halfway Round Your Dreams.
My God. All right, so you took me to the 50s and then immediately brought me into the next millennium. The combination of sounds on that track, again, 100% syncable. I'm a music supervisor, and I would place these tracks night and day. Wilfredo, what'd you think of that one?
Oh, it's too clean, far too clean. It's just everything's, it's like a crystal clear mashup. But you know what I mean? It's like there's so much going on, but you can hear everything. That's the thing. It's just like those guitars are just crystal, and it's like just another sad song done well. But it's done so well, I'm not sad about it. It's just like, you know, it cheers me up. It has got a sad vibe to it, but it's just like, oh, it's beautiful. So it's kind of, you know, and again, the live drums, it's just, do you know what, this just sounds like a jam session, but that's not a diss. It's just so real, you know. It's just, you can imagine the two of them just in the,
Well, think about these great bands, you know, the Dead or Fish. You know, it's all about the jam because they're fucking amazing at
it,
you know.
Yeah, they can do it, that's right. But that comes across, like I think Vinx was saying just now, you know, but you can kill that. You can absolutely murder that sound if you over-perfect it.
Ugh, Milfredo, you are a god. I love you, my friend. Vinx, was that song okay?
Man, let me tell you the truth. Here we go. You ready
Give
for this?
Test.
Just close your eyes and imagine the little girl from the Addams Family fucking goes to college. And she's not feeling right her on. Classmates, okay? Yeah. The date didn't go well, but it's perfect. You just find out what it goes. It's got feeling all over it. It's honest. It's honest, and it takes you to all kind of moods, crescendos and everything. I loved it. It's great. It's what I do in my sleep. You just close your eyes and you're there.
Oh, I love it, Vinx. All right, let's see what Kevin has to say about that track.
Wow, after all those comments, I don't know if I can add to that. Yeah, I mean, this a wonderful track. This one takes me on a journey. This could be a road trip, and, you know, that road trip can be to anywhere. This is another song that I can kind of put in any place. And actually, you know, this song could go in everything from a drama to a comedy to an action adventure to even a psychological thriller. I would put this in any of those. I agree with Milfredo, the clarity of the sound. You know, you're going to be drawn to this track because it has a distinct style all of its own. It's harkens to, you know, some genre songs of the past, but it's updated, it's pure, and I just love it.
I'm with you 100%, Kev. All right, Kreska, what do you think of that one, you beautiful lady?
I would say Hypnotic to start
with. Ooh, I love it.
And what I see when I hear this is a vacation song. The plane is landing. You're arriving in the airport. You get off the plane. this is the song you hear, or it's the song when the characters arrive at the hotel. This is what sets that environment. I also see this in a rom-com. This is like a wedding band at a reception where everyone's hammered and the song is being played. Or this could be like a late night lounge pub song in a bar, and it's like a Halloween party.
Totally. Oh my God, my panel's on fire tonight. Ratty, Jesse, everyone's loving you up. All right, Everton, are we all on the same boat together? Or are we just, it's a love fest tonight.
Yeah, man, it's a love fest. Track was great. Right off the bat, you know, my man Vinks, he said something about Adam's Family, and that's what I was thinking. I got Adam's Family, Transylvania. I got like the House of Frightenstein. I got like the Monsters. Rob Zombie's doing a movie right now, the Monsters he's coming up with. So like that vibe, because I kind of got in it like, you know, towards the end of it, you start getting that eerie sound in it, like that weirding, like, and all that kind of stuff. That really like struck it home for me of where I would send this. So yeah, along those lines of that, like kind of like Frightenstein horror kind of thing, I got that. Also, it's definitely an end title credit track. It would just out a film, like, you know, magically. So, yeah, man, kudos to you guys, man. I mean, nothing wrong with that track at all. I'd place it for days.
Everton, I see why you're being so successful as a music singer, supervisor. Guys, do you want to give us a little background on that track? What have I opened up something to you? Tell us.
Yeah, no. It was just like we went into a studio. We really didn't have much idea apart from the kind of mood that we wanted to create with the tunes and the thing. It's all very emotional, you know. The cool thing is at my age is when I go in the studio and make a record like that, it's like being returned to being 18 or something. You know, you just kind of, it's all a bit fresh and it's all a bit new and it's a direction you haven't gone in before. You know, everything that came up, like instinctive about what we should do with the track and how it should sound. And we have a kind of honesty about, you know, I don't like that because it doesn't work. I can't see where to go with it. And we got enough respect for each other where we say, well, okay, then we'll kill that idea and we'll go in another way. And this was just one of the directions that happened to turn up.
Well, it's because it's a pretty melody, it's a pretty track, but it's finding the kind of poison undercurrent beneath it that just kind of, that's what's going to make the track interesting. Otherwise, it's just another pretty piece of music. But it's really, from the point of view of making this piece of music, that's the real fun, is trying to find that, but without actually spoiling the music, without just like fucking it up for no reason, just trying to find that nice element of danger beneath something that is on the surface just a pretty thing.
So, guys, are you surprised hearing, because you know, the references have been tilting towards horror films, was that something that you anticipated, or is that a surprise response?
I think it's because we both like horror movies and scary things and the unpleasant side. You don't have to consciously do it when you're sort of automatically into that side of life anyway. I said, you know, we like to be frightened, and there's something, you know, pretty things are nice and they're bubbles, they sort of blow around, but if there's something that sets adrenaline rushing very slightly, you know, you don't want too much of it. If there's something there and something pretty, for me it adds a better flavour.
It's Lorca, the Spanish poet, he wrote this essay about what he called duende, which is like this kind of flamenco terminology, and it means a kind of nearness of death. That's what sort of crucial to that whole kind of Spanish flamenco deep song thing, is that you've got this kind of, you know, creepy death on the edge of everything. So hanging over, you know, the beautiful kind of olive groves or whatever, there's always this kind of creeping darkness. And that is a kind of big thing about what drives what we do, I think. We've always got this kind of edge of something creepy and unpleasant. So, you know, we like the nice pretty melody, but it's always nice to have that, because you can't have one without the other. Well, not for us anyway.
Oh my God, two tracks in a row. I'm absolutely in heaven right now. Let's hear, Dawn. I think we have one final track from the Sinclairs tonight.
We do. Pillow Fight Skies.
I mean, who comes up with these names? I mean, Jesse.
They're amazing.
Yeah. This guy's brain is like, to live in his mind for a day would be too much for any of us. I love it already.
Once we were snowflakes that fell down like feathers from stuffed clouds of laughter in winter bright pillow fight skies. Pillow
God.
I should say that that's the singer on that is Jane Horrocks, the English actress from.
Oh, I was going to ask. Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah, from. I think if anyone has seen Chicken Run, she is Brenda the chicken in that. And she's in Little Voice, of course, and all manner of. I mean, Rat, I think you can think of more things she's probably in, but she's been in loads of things.
Oh, my God. So, all right. So, Milfredo, that must have made you happy. We had some vocals on that one.
No, it didn't make me happy that one. Jesse's going, I'm going to get you some happy pills or something for Easter, you two. It's just like, angst, sadness, heartache. It's just,
no, you're going to fuck up his writing.
I am. They're just not in my vocab. But hey, the world would be a boring place if we were all the same. And I'm that guy you're just talking about, Jesse and Jason, who doesn't read anymore. The like real shallow person. And it's just like, yeah, it's far, far too highbrow for me, that one. A psychiatrist should have a field day with you two, I think.
I should say that really the reason we did that was because it was an unashamed attempt to try and have a seasonal hit, you know, like a Christmas record. But the funny thing about it was it got written and everything, and then we didn't realise how miserable it was until Jane pointed it out and said, you know, there are a lot of people that actually do spend their Christmas on their own. They're quite miserably getting drunk. And I thought, this is amazing. We've plugged into a market, which is every housewife divorcee with a bottle of Prosecco, you know. But it hasn't quite worked like that. But
yeah, no, but I get it. I get it. It's I'm on the fence on that one. It's just, I don't get it, if you know what I mean. I can see where you've gone with it completely.
But look, we do need these anti-holiday songs. It, you know, this is something that filmmakers, you know, are looking for. It's not just, you know, happy Christmas for everybody.
In fact, that's the thing. I'm listening to it not from a filmmaker's ear. Do you know what I mean? And that's just something completely different. Different, isn't it? And so yeah, I get it for a film, obviously. It's just I'm too shallow to understand it.
Oh, no, look, you are a machine when it comes to production and getting songs into that pop radio world. What you do, Milfredo, is so unique. It's why we have you part of the show. Vinx, what are your thoughts?
Come on, you know, I think it speaks well for the disenfranchised. I just, from my first thought was, this is Edward Scissorhands' daughter.
Yes.
For Christmas. It was perfectly wrong for a lot of things. I thought it was great.
I love it. I love it. I love it. I love you both. I mean, again, this has just been, you know, I think we've been doing the show for 6 or 7 months now. And I am going to say that tonight has hit a plateau for me. This is what I dream, you know? This is how I want to spend my nights. Thank you, Jess. Thank you, Rat. This has just been incredible.
Thank you so much to our amazingly talented guests for joining us on today's show, and to you, our listeners, for spending your time listening to us and being with us. The Sync Report cast will be back in a week with your hosts, myself, Colin O'Donoghue, Rose Ganguza, and Jason P. Rothberg. Until next time, take care and be kind.
Thank you for listening. Tune in next week.